What you call that noise?
The XTC Podcast.
What do you call that noise?
What do you call that noise?
Is it that time already? This is the 50th episode of What Do You Call That Noise, the XTC podcast, and it feels like we've only just begun. If you're new here, welcome. If you're an old hand, welcome back. This is the place where we've heard Andy Partridge say...
I can't think what that piece of music's called. The bum, 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 ba-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Kind of spooky music.
Where we've heard Colin Moulding say...
I think there are people who are not themselves most of their life, and I like to think that they eventually do become themselves. But it can be a bit of a struggle to conform to what society wants of you, you know. It's a battle.
Where we've heard Dave Gregory say...
There was always... plenty, almost like an embarrassment of riches there. You know, it's too much choice. Sometimes you can have too much choice. That's one reason why the album's a double album. We didn't feel comfortable about throwing anything out.
Where we've heard Terry Chambers say...
I think the isolation of actually coming from Swindon was a little bit of an advantage for us, in as much that it made us a little bit different from the rest.
That's in addition to visits from Stephen Wilson, Jen Olive, John Leckie, Jasmine Villette, Hugh Padgham and the Bishop of Leeds, Pat Kane, Nick Haywood, Brian van der Ark, Chris Butler, Martin Newell, Stuart Lee and many, many more fans, friends and famous folk besides. Hello, I'm Mark Fisher and you still haven't got rid of me. Sorry about that, but not sorry to say that today we're going back to the formative years of XTC in the company of Ian Doser, who was in Swindon's first punk band, The Aggravators, and has been sharing his memories of XTC and others in a book called A Big Fish in a Small Puddle. And with him in this conversation is his drummer, Lee Moulding, who has a lifetime of memories growing up as a child of XTC. That's coming up in a minute. But first, let's hear some of the sounds you've been cooking up. And this month, it's the turn of Beth Link, who is going to welcome us to her happy place.
What do you call that noise?
Hiya, Mark, and hello, fellow XTC fans. My name is Beth. I live in Ohio, and I've been an XTC fan since 1995, when a friend of mine turned me on to Oranges and Lemons. Of course, I fell in love instantly, and I've been a fan ever since. This is a song I wrote called My Happy Place. So far, it's an instrumental, but I'd absolutely love to have professional musicians add lyrics, bass, drums. I think it could turn into a pretty decent little tune. So on the outro, I hear in my head a really cool guitar solo that slowly fades out, sort of like Andy's lead on My Land Is Burning. I think that'd be super, super cool. Anyway, here goes nothing. Thank you, Mark, for this opportunity, and thank you all for listening. Press play now. Thank you.
What do you call that noise?
Lovely. Thanks, Beth. And if you fancy taking up Beth's offer to work on the track further, get in touch with me and I'll put you in touch with her. You can get me at mark@xtclimelight.com. And that's also the address you can use to send your XTC-inspired music, although I have to say there is a long waiting list ahead of you, I'm afraid. The podcast couldn't happen without the generous supporters on Patreon, who we all owe a tremendous debt to. If you like what you hear, and there's 50 episodes to choose from, you'd like to join them, I'm sure, and it's very straightforward to do that. Just pop over to patreon.com/MarkFisher and decide on your level of support. There are three levels, and if you opt to be a knight in shining karma, I'll read out your name at the end of each episode.
What do you call that noise?
Today we're going into deepest Swindon to meet two musicians with a fascinating backstory. First up, we have Ian Dosa, whose new book claims he's a big fish in a small puddle. It is a tale of sex and drugs and rock and roll and fags and curry. And it's a memoir of Ian's time as a guitarist and singer on the Swindon music scene, notably with his band The Hamsters from Hell, and also with Swindon's first new wave band, The Aggravators, who supported XTC. And as well as XTC, it includes encounters with famous bands such as Dr. Feelgood, The Clash, Wilco Johnson, The Meteors, Doctor and the Medics, and loads more. And it also involves a lot of beer. Hello, Ian. How are you doing?
All good now that we've worked out the technology.
So yeah, we're ahead of the game. Welcome to the podcast. And sitting with Ian, this is equally as exciting, is his drummer, a man whose surname you might recognise. It's Lee Moulding. Hello, Lee.
Hello, nice to speak to you.
Great to have you on, Lee. Lee has also worked with, well, loads of bands, works as a drum teacher as well. And he's worked with Steve Tilling, who's a previous guest on the podcast, is part of Circus, and was on backing vocals and percussion in the TC&I gigs in 2018 with Terry Chambers and his dad, Colin Moulding. So both of them have got a lot of backstory. I'm not even too sure where I should begin, but maybe it's your book, Ian. So let's start with your book. What motivated you to put all of your experiences down in one publication?
Many years ago, about 2010, 2011, a few people I was telling different tales to suggested I wrote a book. And I did put some notes down, some headers, and but never got around to filling in any details. Then when COVID struck, I was put a couple of stories up on Facebook and people liked them, put a smile on people's faces, lighted up a boring day. And then my co-writer, Ellis Bird, who used to live in Swindon in the 80s, but has been living in various states in the US since then, contacted me. He's written dozens of books and said if I wanted to write it down, he'd put it together, so it was readable. And eventually we got there. After discovering that my feeble brain was better than AI programs.
But actually, you talk about a feeble brain, but there's just loads and loads and loads of detail that is the sort of thing that I personally would have forgotten. But it seems, there's a few details that you admit to forgetting along the way, but there's loads of very precise memories. Does your memory work particularly well? Did all those things come flooding back as soon as you started writing about it?
Yeah. It was one thing would remind me of something else, and I'd jot a note down and then fill out the details as I was going along. Ellis did a lot of research for me, which helps, and band members past and present, friends who were involved in the individual situations and everything. It's a bit of a collaboration over a decade and a half, and we got there in the end. And it's getting a good response from what I can see.
Yeah. It's going. I was just looking at some of the comments already on Amazon that are hugely enthusiastic, and I've been enjoying reading it. And to give people an idea, particularly from an XTC point of view, you were at exactly the right age for the birth of XTC. You were sort of a teenager in the mid-70s, and I think your first connection is, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think your first connection to the band was through Barry Andrews, is that right?
Yeah, me and Barry went through the same school system. He was 2 years above me in school, So we, you know, passed by. But then when I was in my mid-teens, due to music, where we became friends. And then when I started playing myself, he was encouraging. He got me my first ever gig. And that was shortly after he joined XTC. And through Barry, I got to know the rest of the band members.
That was a tremendously exciting moment in music history, because you've got that sort of combination of the, I don't know, if you could, the sort of pub rock, bluesy, Dr. Feelgood kind of music, but then also the energy of punk that was coming in. Was it, what was the sort of atmosphere around Swindon at the time? Was it sort of trading on all of that?
Yeah, I mean, Swindon was actually one of the first outposts of punk outside London. Ian Reid, horrible bastard that he was, put a lot of up-and-coming bands on in his club. And as far as I'm aware, the deal was he put the agency's band in at the Affair in exchange for getting XTC a gig on the London pub circuit, which helped their career immensely.
You supported XTC, but you also saw them live, I think, loads of times. What sort of impression were they making in those days before they were signed and before, you know, before they were a professional band?
I thought they were really good. They, you know, blew me away within a few songs. First time I saw them, those few songs were the opening ones of White Music.
Mm-hmm.
About the time they were signed, they played a gig at Swindon Oasis Leisure Centre. It was put on by Swindon Viewpoint, the local cable channel. And that's where I met some women from London at a gig. And this was, as far as I know, XTC's first travelling bands. They made bands in pubs in London who started travelling around, following them around.
I was in the wings as a child on that Oasis gig.
And I'm fascinated, Lee, what are your memories of that time? I mean, how good are your memories from that time? Because you're obviously very, very, very young.
Well, yeah, not too good. I think I was more interested in Star Wars figures.
Yeah, yeah.
I have very vague recollections of, you know, being stood to the side of the stage watching that play. Other than that, it was just kind of Dad not being home, really.
Because it's a difficult question, isn't it? Because the question I'm tempted to ask you is, what was it like being a child of someone who was in a modestly successful and very busy, certainly, rock band? But you don't know anything else, do you? That was your life.
Yeah, it was certainly in the early days. It was just Dad not being there, you know. And that was kind of it. And it wasn't until, obviously, when they stopped touring that he spent a lot more time at home.
Yeah. And how, you would have been still quite young when they stopped touring in 1982, would you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I would have been 8.
Yeah, so that's ideal time to see your dad again.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And did you go through a kind of rebellious phase of that most kids go through, of sort of wanting to have nothing to do with your dad, nothing, in your case it would be nothing to do with bass guitar or nothing to do with music, or were you, I don't know, proud of what he was up to?
No, absolutely. As it was in my sort of early teens, I was sort of, I think it was just kind of, you know, what would be the music that would be furthest away from what your parents were into? And, you know, I grew up sort of listening to, obviously I loved the Kinks and the Beatles and everything as well. But, I was into rap. I was into Public Enemy and all that sort of in my early teens, sort of growing up and as a rebelling against my parents sort of thing, you know.
Going normal.
And did you have a sneaking suspicion for XTC? Or, I mean, you might not. Oh, well, actually, you've been in the TC&I gig, so I presume you came around to a point when you actually liked the music. But what was your? Did you listen to what your dad was producing?
Yeah, I did, but it was kind of, I would sort of explore my dad's taste in music more. My dad and I were huge, massive Kinks fans.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously the Beatles. He introduced me to Frank Zappa and Captain Beefheart, that sort of side of things. And it was more kind of exploring that kind of his taste as well.
And it often seems to me that, actually Ian could answer this question as well, but it often seems to me that successful musicians have often got musical parents because, you know, you're in an atmosphere where playing music is normal, and you know, maybe they encourage you to have lessons or whatever, or teach you a few tricks or whatever. Do you think that influenced you, that just having music in the air was influential you in becoming, well, for the two of you, it's definitely true. I don't know about Ian's parents.
My mum had apparently recorded a song singing in a what would be the musical equivalent of a photo booth.
You know, right.
And that was the only musical connection in any of the family, from what I know. My dad, although he gave me half of the money for my first ever acoustic guitar as a 16th birthday present, didn't really encourage me. As a matter of fact, he ended up throwing me out of the house. due to my liking for the rock and roll lifestyle, and booze, women, and making lots of noise, which disturbed not only the neighbours, but the two council estates away. I had a wall of Marshall amps, a drum kit, in my dad's bedroom, which my bedroom band, which is mentioned in the book, which somehow became Swindon's first punk band. But no, I never really had. My mum, my parents split up when I was 11, and I met up with my mum again shortly after I'd started gigging. She seemed quite encouraging, you know, but no, I had no real support from. I had more support from Lee's family than I had from my own. Myself and Lee first met when Lee was about three. Colin was away on tour, and I saw Lee's mum struggling with two kids and loads of shopping bags, and I helped her carry her home when I first met Lee and Joe. Although next time I met Lee was about 30 years ago, and he obviously didn't remember it, but we hit it off straight away.
Oh, that's funny, yeah, because I was going to ask you, Lee, about that. You so it's not like Ian has always been around in your life, even though he has.
Yeah, absolutely. There was obviously, we met in that instance when I was a toddler, but there was a long time after that where we didn't really see each other at all, really. And it wasn't until I was sort of exploring the Swindon music scene and sort of going to pubs and all that by myself, because my parents wouldn't really go out into town, really, because we lived out just outside Swindon. So I was sort of, you know, just venturing out into Swindon on my own, going to gigs on my own, and obviously girls were a big attraction. just going to venues, meeting musicians and stuff, and that was when I sort of hooked up with Ian again, you know.
And you can explain, Lee, because for people who don't come from Swindon, the name of Ian Dosa, I don't think has travelled very far, but what is Ian's significance within Swindon itself?
Oh, he's a legend. I asked my dad what it was like playing with Ian on the same stage, you know, when he was in XTC in the 70s. And he said, well, nobody wanted to play with the Aggravators because they were so good, they'd blow everyone off stage, you know. And he said, we didn't really like playing with them because they were so good. Of course, after then, the Hamsters from Hell were on the scene, and they've been going so long, you know, they're an institution.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much, you know, you cut your teeth on with the Hamsters from Hell, really. And, if you can play with the Hamsters from Hell, you can play with anyone.
And why is that?
Just purely because every gig is different. Even though you might be playing the same songs, every gig is different, and you're given free rein, really, to go on a jazz excursion if you wish, and. You have to see them to believe them.
And is it, where does that come from, Ian? Because, you know, there are some people who just do like the chaos of the live experience, or the life of the live experience, if you like. It doesn't have to be chaotic. But where do you think that comes from within you, not wanting to do, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but, you know, not wanting to do the most polished thing, but to do the most exciting thing?
Part of this, we're all getting old and senile and can't remember how we played the song.
Yeah, but you've always been like that.
At times, the Hamsters and I have been a pure jam band, yeah? We put people up, you know, they'd be playing at a jam session in a pub in the lunchtime, and they're playing with us in the evening. So it's, you know, we just had some songs are pretty much the same every time, but others are just a real loose jam. And it's just evolved that way. most of the band have been in it for 39 years now since our first gig. Lee's a big part of it on and off for the last 25 of them. But there's me, keyboards player, lead guitarist and harmonica player, have been there since we started in 1985 as the Hamsters from Hell. Kev Deegan, the keyboards player, has been playing me for a few years before that with Peter's band. Yeah, it's a necessity. I've knocked up a 10-piece band after hours drinking session in a pub, went to play one of the most professional venues in Bristol, totally jamming it. And the sound man at the end of the night said if he wants skin, he would have paid us for doing the job. But so it's very rarely disastrous, but it does have its off nights.
Is there something about your personality that is comfortable with that? Because many people would think, many performers, they want to do as slick and as polished and as perfect a show as possible. But the downside of that is it can also be a bit boring. What you're doing is more interesting. But is there something about your personality that's prepared to fall flat on your face?
Yeah, it happens sometimes. But my idea is if you join the band, even whether it's standing for a gig or you join the band, you play what you want. I'll only ever say something if it doesn't work. Yeah, so everybody who's up there, if they're not enjoying themselves, that's their fault, not anyone else's. You know, most people say, like, they stood in with us for what was going to be our farewell gig and, you know, still sits in with us occasionally now. You know, John Bucket, who same helped us out for a gig and stayed for over 10 years. You know, we've had numerous people guests with us. Most of XTC have played with us for a few songs and have been, including Colin. I've had the Meteors as my backing band at an impromptu gig. Got up on stage and sung with Wilco Johnson. Now, I just enjoy getting up and making an ass of myself, really. I'm not a very good singer. I'm not a very good guitarist, but I write most of the songs. So I put a steady rhythm down. Everybody else adds their bits to it. But when I'm comfortable with what's going on behind me, on a good day, I can probably be one of the best front men you will ever hear. We'll see.
I think somewhere in the book you describe Lee as being one of the best, or the best drummer in the area. What is it that Lee brings to your band?
Individuality.
Youth.
Yeah, youth.
Youth.
We always have good, young, good-looking drummers. Probably hide them away, I might say, get all the groupies. Well, I most certainly ain't.
Lee, what's it like to play in a band that has that? I mean, I imagine it's very different from, you know, whether it's with TCNI or with Steve Tilling or all the other people that you've played with. I imagine the mood of playing with this band is different.
It just takes it down to its core element, which is just fun.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's that's the priority of what it's all supposed to be about, really. It's why you do it. It's just because it's fun. And that's exactly what it is. And after the fun, obviously, there is a bit of work to do, you know, sort of learning the songs and turning up and playing. But again, it's why you do it, because it's fun.
And in that sense, it's like you've developed in a tradition that sort of does begin with Wilco, but that sort of performative side of things, that there was a whole load of bands around in that sort of mid-70s where the performance, the fun was in the performance. It wasn't about necessarily going into a studio and recording records.
No, it doesn't really need to be polished at all. I think there's a little bit of angst there, which is nice and exciting to watch if it's a little bit more unrehearsed.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously I've done the other end of the scale, which is, you know, everything has to be pinpoint accurate and I don't find it as fun.
Squid I saw not long ago, and what was fantastic about Squid is that you could really get a sense of all the different musicians in the band listening to each other and moving in whatever direction they were going that night. So although they were playing the songs, it wasn't, you know, they weren't sort of completely improvising. There was a sense of listening to each other, and I think that's must be what you get in that situation.
It's testament to all the musicians in the Hamsters from Hell, really. They all are exciting to watch, and they all bring an element to it, which is great, and it it works. It's exciting.
Ian, as Lee just said, there was that feeling among XTC that they didn't want to be blown off the stage by you and what you were doing. But from your point of view, was there something different that XTC were doing which did set them apart and did make them, if you like, more professional or more operating on a national scale or international scale?
They were the outstanding band locally. You know, I never realised how big they were going to become. You know, they were just a very good local band when I first heard them. That. But yeah, every person in there was a great player. Andy and Barry bouncing off each other because some of that was jammed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was an inspiration to me. And I was playing bass in the first couple of bands I was in. So Colin sort of became my mentor. He's given me lots of encouragement and tips and everything. It's just getting to know a nice bunch of people who you really looked up to playing-wise and everything. You know, I had some really nice evenings out with them. Not, you know, took me out on the odd gig with them and everything. Till Mr. Reed got his nose in, he hated me and I hated him. I still do. Not sure if he's still about it, he still hates me. I think I might have won over the members of XTC with that because I could say what they couldn't.
Yeah, legally you can, yeah.
Well, I think Terry, because he wasn't subject to all the nasty end of things, there's a podcast from the last fan convention, which I think you were part of, where he said about Reed and his briefcase and banging Dennis Stebridge's head on the floor.
It's very funny, that, yeah.
Well, I remember a similar story just when I was on the tour supporting Barry Andrews when he left XTC. We had to go to the office to get some more of the sheets of all the info of the gigs and everything. After my bass player at the time had wiped his bum on the previous ones as we were going across the 17th.
I've read that story. I think you leave that one to the readers.
And so we're in Reed's office and Dennis Beveridge was there, and Dennis had had to sort out nastiness from the previous night's gig, not caused by the bands at all. And he'd fallen asleep and Ian Reed, kick Dennis, he's fallen asleep again. No consideration whatsoever. But he sent Dennis out to do his dirty work because he couldn't be bothered. And then most because Dennis has been awake for 24 hours and fallen asleep in his chair in the office.
But at the same time, I get the impression that as you've already said, actually, that the affair was without that as a club. I don't know what would have happened instead, but it sounds like it was a really exciting venue to be at in those days.
It was. Give Ian Reed credit where it's due. Yes, he turned that place somewhere on the live map. And there's another bigger venue, the Brunel Rooms as well, which XTC used to play at quite a lot before I knew them. You know, they were putting on the bigger gigs because they had three or four times the capacity. But yeah, for a good year and a half, I'd say, Swindon was definitely on the map. So I got the support of Clash, XTC, the only ones, although that wasn't in Swindon, the only ones. A band called The Killjoys, which is Kevin Rowlands from Dexley's Midnight Runners, and a few others. There's a band called Advertising, which EMI had just signed for loads of money, and we blew them off stage. Which probably didn't go down too well, the EMI people.
Did you always conceive of yourself as a live band, or did you have ambitions to go into the studio and go down the route that those other bands got? Would you have liked to have got a record contract and done that whole thing?
Probably initially, yes, but I started gigging at the age of 18, and by the age of 20, I was totally disillusioned with all the business side of it that I encountered as an outsider and just never had any interest after that. We did get offered a record deal in the mid-80s with the Hamsters from Hell, but it was going to be a one-off single that wasn't even one of our own songs, so I suspect the person in charge of this label probably had the owner, rights for the song. And it was just a 15 minutes of fame and no money, so I didn't bother.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, it's making me wonder whether, Lee, that you've learned a few lessons from your dad in terms of the exploitation of the record industry. Is that, have you been cautious from that point of view?
Yeah, absolutely. There were big courthouse wranglings and things going on with regards with XTC. So I was always quite wary anyway. A lot of the industry people that I met, along with a few exceptions that were lovely, most of them that I met were just not very nice people.
Mm-hmm.
I could kind of sense that even as a young child, you know. Yeah, so I did have a preordained, not resentment, that's a bit strong, but I was very wary of the business side of things, still am. I think the onslaught of the internet, there are some very bad downsides to it as a musician, but I also think there are some very good sides to it.
In the sense that you can get your music out there if you want to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, it totally bypasses the need for labels, and people should explore a bit more, I think.
And what it suggests to me as well, for both of you, is that that you've managed to keep music central, not business central or fame central. It's the love of music is the reason that you're doing it.
Absolutely. And it's very different growing up, you know, wanting to make it big in a band, you know, and it's not possible now. I don't think, wanting to play your own stuff and not being part of the machine. I don't think it's possible now, really. So it's obviously a good idea to, you know, get your website up and go in and just do your own thing and hope people like it and use live gigs to put the word about, really.
I'm intrigued to know, as a drummer, have you learnt, or what have you learnt from Terry Chambers? I mean, you've been on the same stage as Terry Chambers. How do you rate him as a drummer? He's the drummer that you grew up with, literally grew up with.
Yeah, when I was very small, I used to have a little go on his kit and what have you. But it was kind of, again, it was that thing where I'm going to completely ignore what my father does and rebel and go and do something else. So when I'd done my sort of rap rebellion, as it were, the Who, the Beatles, I would concentrate on those drummers, really. I'm a bit of a fad follower, I suppose. You know, I was into the whole Manchester thing. When that happened, I was the grunge thing was a big thing when I was in my teens. And there's a couple of drummers from the grunge period that I absolutely love. Matt Cameron from Soundgarden, he was a big influence on my drumming.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking that the Manchester thing in particular, there was that sort of really interesting collision between effectively what I would call disco and the sort of the indie sounds that came together. So the rhythm was crucial there, wasn't it? It was putting people on the dance floor.
Stone Roses, Rennie from the Stone Roses, he was also a big influence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Ride from Oxford, I used to really like what they did as well.
Yeah. And did you feel though that you were able to step out and put your own stamp on things?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You can only play what you like playing and what you want to play, you know. So it was very much an amalgamation of everything that influenced me. You know.
Drummers. Before me, we had a drummer who used to use a lot of artificial stimulation. So what do you say, yeah? And he only had two speeds of playing. It was either before he powdered his nose, everything would be slow blues speed. And after he powdered his nose, even slow blues would be Motorhead speed.
Quite exciting to play with, I would have thought.
But he was a nightmare. He was okay in the early days, yeah? Yeah, but then his habit got too bad. But Lee was a breath of fresh air. And myself and Lee had known each other a few years by the time he first played with Hampton somehow. But we had this rehearsal for what was going to be my final gig ever. And we did half a dozen songs, went out for a smoke break, and Lee played a different beat to every one of those songs. And he just worked that out from having listened to us and what his interpretation was. And it saved the band. If it hadn't been for that practice and Lee's enthusiasm and deciding he wanted to join the band, we probably wouldn't be going now. But I have been lucky since Lee because we've attracted most of the best drummers around. The only one we haven't had is Terry, but who knows, he's in Swindon, it might happen at some point.
Yeah, you never know.
That'd be every member of the recording lineup to the XTC in Amsterdam. We had Andy recording with us and helping my songwriting. Dave Codding and Barry have jammed with us. So the only one we haven't got is Terry, and that'd be the full set.
Can you identify what you, from in all of those people you've just mentioned, Colin, Dave, Andy, Barry, can you identify what you learnt from each one of them? You know, what was it like to have Andy advising you on songwriting?
It wasn't so much advising me, it was helping me with a couple of songs over the years. But when we went in the recording studio with Andy, going to be producing it, but as it happened, he couldn't do the final mixes. He had, you know, a paying job rather than doing us a favour. But yeah, we all learnt songcraft. The bloke who ran the studio learned how to use his equipment differently from what the manuals and so, yeah, all the experience. The others were all jamming live, so it was just enjoyment and, you know, fun on the moment. Didn't really actually learn anything because we never rehearsed together or anything. It was just totally spontaneous.
I'm just thinking back to those support gigs you did for XTC and whether, well, let's leave it open about whether or not you blew them off the stage, but that must have been, for you to be in those audiences early on in the, whatever it was, 1977, 1978, I'd imagine audiences were particular. I mean, I'm a couple of years younger than you, so I was probably not going to gigs until maybe 1980 or so. My impression is that it was, you know, great and exciting to be young and in a gig in that era.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was Lee who told me that Colin had thought we'd blown XTC off stage at the first gig we supported him in the Rochester Castle pub in Stoke Newington. And I can remember the two bands being sat round. XTC invited my band, which was called the Purges at the time. There's a few of us from the Aggravators still in it. And they said, I don't expect any response. No one ever gets up and dances or anything here. We had to place up dancing. And they were apparently worried that they wouldn't be able to follow on. But they went down in a storm. All they needed was someone to warm the audience up. You know? There's no doubt that they were going to be great after us being okay. You know, we weren't anything musical, just a punk thrashy band.
But by the sound of it, you have always been good at getting the audience up and dancing and giving people a good time, whether it's, you know, and then they can go to the next level.
Yeah, it's the first gig I ever done. It was a bit cramped on the stage, so after about 10 seconds, I jumped out on the dance floor and started, you know, bouncing about amongst the audience while I was playing the bass and never looked back on that bit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Nowadays, I get a bit old and decrepit and don't bounce about so much, but audience participation, if you stare at your shoes, the audience will. You look them in the face and, same as I do, make some inappropriate comments over the microphone every once in a while, get their attention. If the music's good as well, which is generally the hamster's smell, you know, you get a good response.
That's brilliant advice, actually. And you just learned that on stage then, but through the process of doing it.
Yeah. You know, I got no formal training whatsoever. As Lee has mentioned about the other members of the Hamster Smell, I'm probably the worst musician in the band by mile, but it's my ideas song-wise and everybody puts their own bit to it. And I'd say that a lot of the band members, past and present, have been some of the best in the area on their instruments. It's just been, you know, you catch the right person at the right time, really.
Just talking to you, it strikes me that you're not well, tell me whether this is right. Offstage, maybe you're not an extrovert, but on stage you can become an extrovert.
I can be very quiet, or, you know, if I'm in company I feel comfortable with, yeah, I'd probably still be the life and soul of the party, but sometimes I'm a miserable soul who sits there drunk in the corner and doesn't speak to anyone.
In the world of XTC, you were just at the perfect time to watch that band get signed, do their early gigs, do their first albums and so on. And I think from your book, I know that you were hearing material from Go 2, for example, before it had even been recorded. That it must have been an exciting time to be following that story as it happened.
Yeah. It was everything was spontaneous. There was very little that was already planned in our interactions, but we all just hit it off straight away. I remember going to a party at Colin's parents' house. They used to go around Andy's various places. And Colin was really the one I saw the least due to him having a young family. And Terry, we bumped into each other. We generally have a few beers, whatever. And Barry, I spent an awful lot of time with until he moved out of Swindon, about 1980. Dave, I didn't really, we've always known each other since before he joined XTC, but it's only probably last 15 years since I've been living out in the town centre area. And he lives quite close to me. We bump into each other in the supermarket. So he's the most recent one that I've spent a bit more time with. Well, it's very occasional. I've become a bit of a recluse in the last few years.
Because I suppose Barry was the first of them that you knew. Did you take sides when the whole thing exploded and Barry left the band?
Not at all. No need to. They were adults, We probably got a bit niggly, I don't know, because I read some things and heard some things on podcasts which showed how bad the situation was between Barry and some of the others, particularly Andy, but I never experienced it myself. I don't remember Barry ever saying anything apart from being frustrated about he had all these songs and most of them didn't end up on Go 2.
Mm-hmm.
But you see the bigger picture, it's quite understandable, really. You've got three songwriters. No one's, apart from Andy with his world dominance thing, which I never experienced firsthand either.
It's funny with Barry because his keyboards were a defining element of the XTC sound on those first two albums, but he was actually only with the band for a couple of years. He was in and out, really. It was just like any of the band members that you've worked with over the years.
Because that was the time where I probably saw him play most live, because after Barry left, Dave joined, they really took off in a big way and was on tour most of the time for a couple of years. So, I didn't see him play as often. And Barry, obviously is quite a big part of XTC in the time I was going to see him live. But if you look at the bigger picture, he's blink and you missed him, wasn't it?
When you knew him at school, was he an impressive musician, even at school? Because I remember him telling me that he used to play the school piano and that sort of thing.
He was one of the influences that inspired me to play.
Yeah.
I never played keyboards, but watching Barry play a couple of times at school concerts with a band playing his own compositions, it's, I suppose, fairly proggish, but it did seem like it was jammed to a certain extent. Then Wilco Johnson, and I was always a big Slade fan, so it was people with a bit of life and character about them.
Yeah. People used to say that they'd go and see XTC just to see Terry Chambers play because he was such a sort of energetic drummer. But Barry on stage was also, for a keyboard, a very dynamic presence.
Yeah. Oh, I'd always be watching Terry.
Yeah.
Someone put something on, may have been the CCI page on Facebook, about they used to watch him counting, keeping time. Buck, four. Which I never heard because it was his jumps. I do remember watching him counting, and they invited me to one of the TCNI secret warm-up shows.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and I went along, and part of the way through I remembered seeing his comments, so I was watching Terry's mouth.
And then you were in the support band before Barry when he left XTC, weren't you? And briefly, Barry was actually in your band supporting himself.
Yeah. Virgin Records didn't seem to like that one. I had... originally, when Barry left XTC, he was a former band and he wanted me to play bass. But because he'd been away for most of the previous year, he didn't realise I'd sort to six string and didn't have any bass gear. So he offered me the support slot on the tour.
Mm-hmm.
And I had myself and a bass player. The bass player had only ever done one gig in his life, and I'd done about a dozen or so. And so we had Barry's guitarist playing drums and Barry Fancy playing sax. So we did a couple of gigs with that lineup, and then as the first week and a bit of the tour went on, I had an ever-changing lineup, ending up with me doing a solo gig in the Hope and Anchor in London, which, according to one of the music papers critics, who unfortunately weren't working, it was more entertaining than Otway and Barrett.
Well, there you are. But I imagine quite in Otway and Barrett is a good comparison from what, you know, the kind of scene that you were in. It was that they're very similar in their approach.
Yeah. I supported John Otway doing a solo gig a few weeks ago. Otway's still great fun life and a nice bloke to get on with as well.
On that tour, did it attract a whole load of disappointed XTC fans, or did Barry sort of reinvent himself faster than that?
I don't remember any disappointed XTC fans, but yes, there were definitely a lot of XTC fans had gone watching.
Yeah, seeing what was happening next.
Yeah, you know, because he was doing pretty much all his own material from what I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and he had some good songs, which some of were recorded, as far as I know, for Go To, but never ended up on the finished thing. Then he just went off and done his various own things and end up in Shriekback.
Yeah, and because of the era, Lee, I'm just kind of thinking you must have seen your dad on the telly, mustn't you? That must have been a weird thing.
Yes, it was. I remember sort of going to school, primary school, and sort of saying, "Oh, my dad's going to be on telly on Saturday morning TV tomorrow." And then, of course, everyone, yeah, right. And, of course, there he was. You know, so it was. It's quite weird. It's quite weird. It can be quite a weird thing.
Because they were. I mean, they got a lot of coverage at that time. I mean, I got into them in 1979. So, and there was at that point, it wasn't necessarily reflected in the amount of records they sold, but they were on Multicoloured Swap Shop, and they were on Top of the Pops and Magpie and all of these other things. So their visibility was pretty high for that time. And I don't know if that was embarrassing for you as a child or something to be proud of.
No, not really. I mean, everything they've done, obviously, I've always been extremely proud of what Dad's done. But it's kind of, there's the other side of the coin as well, where being a musician, everyone always compares you to XTC or whatever, and it's always brought up in conversation. So, you know, if I don't know someone, I won't bring it. I won't mention it at all.
No, I can see that. Yeah,
I do try and sort of steer away from that conversation and being likened to or compared to my dad, I just try and steer clear of it, really.
Till you get dragged onto a podcast and forced out of you.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Sometimes you just get forced.
I made a mistake a few years ago down in Cornwall. We were locking after a gig in a pub, and someone said, "Oh, you're from Swindon, do you know XTC?" And I didn't realise this thing about me steering clear of it. So I said, "Oh, yeah, the Colin Moulding's son." And that was it. Lee got chased around the pub, 20 questions for the next couple of hours, and grabbed me by the throat and said, "Don't you ever fucking say that again."
Yeah, sometimes you do get confronted with it, but it's not a discourteous thing. It's more of a, I need to concentrate what I want to do. You know, I don't want to sort of get dragged back to the same conversation. I kind of want to, although we can hear. I just kind of like, look, I'm more of a look forward kind of guy, and I much prefer to concentrate on what I'm doing and try and not prove myself, but just do the best I can as a musician.
Yeah. And it is interesting looking, you know, at people who are sort of real major celebrities. So, you know, someone like Rufus Wainwright, or there are various people who've managed to, or Stella McCartney, sort of reinventing themselves in a high profile way, but still managing to do the thing that they want to do in their own terms, but they're for all of them, I think there's a point when they have to sever themselves from the expectations and just prove themselves and do it in their own terms, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. You've kind of got to veer away and do your own thing. And I've always kind of tried to do that, really.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Previous bands I've been in, they've asked me back, you know, sort of, let's do a reunion gig. And I've always turned it down because I'm much more of a, it's time to do something new and move on. And I've always kind of tried to look forward.
Play my old shit.
Yeah. I was going to say play the same old shit, but.
And what are your memories, Lee, after the period that we're talking about? Because you were given, for all that we're talking about, you were given some tremendous opportunities, I think, to go to recording studios or go around the world or whatever. What other experiences did you have as the child of someone who was in a pop group?
Obviously, I was very fortunate I got to go to a lot of different countries and meet some famous people and go to some recording studios. Going to New York was always a big event, you know. I think I've been sort of maybe 5-6 times to New York. And we lived in Los Angeles for a few months while Dad was recording. I think that was the Oranges and Lemons, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was very, very fortunate, really. Obviously, the XTC tour with the Police.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
Obviously met Sting and the Beat and all that, and played doubles on a pinball machine with Sting when I was a kid. But yeah, you know, little things you remember. And I remember the little trip to Canada to record the Casby show.
Yeah.
We did the Dear God performance. You know, you just remember little trips and that sort of time when and obviously Andy was a big influence then. He was the fun uncle, you know, a funcle. That's what he was. And so I was very fortunate.
Yeah. And again, thinking about the what you do now as a musician, music and doing music professionally was just an ordinary thing for you. It was the family business. It was just what happened. It wasn't something extraordinary as it would be. You know, the idea of meeting Sting is extraordinary for most people, but it was just part of your life as a child growing up.
Yeah, there was obviously those highlights, but I've never actually been solely a professional musician. I've always, you know, obviously having the young family, I couldn't go away touring.
Mm-hmm.
Another, you know, I have a disabled son as well, which I look after, and so there was always, you know, you got to put bread on the table, haven't you? So I've always kind of done, you know, I have been a professional musician, and I've been lucky enough to tour and play music and be paid for it, but I've always had a day job, as it were.
Yeah. You're one of these people who likes earning money.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, I don't know why. Well, I work for the NHS now, so
right.
I'm funny enough, a wheelchair technician for the NHS.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And in that sense, how do you find playing with Ian? And is it like a question of fitting in around days off and evenings and whatever else your time schedule allows?
Well, really, you have to consult the boss.
That's not
and,
me.
And that's no, it's neither of us, I'm afraid. obviously if I get if I'm lucky enough to be I wouldn't say allowed out, but if I'm lucky enough to that she doesn't mind looking after everyone and I can go and do my own thing, which I'm very fortunate she does a lot of the time, I'm more than happy to go out and enjoy myself.
And actually as we've been discussing with Ian, if you are playing with a band that doesn't hold great stock about playing every note in the right order and all the rest of it, then you know, it's not like you have to do 6 weeks of rehearsal for every gig that you do.
No, exactly. I mean, we at the start we did a few rehearsals, didn't we? And then it was kind of right. You've learnt the basics. Now you can expand on it and. We certainly did that over the years, didn't we?
When Lee first joined, bass player, long-term bass player of the time, Nick, had started running a pub in Cirencester, about 15, 20 miles from Swindon. We had a rehearsal space booked. Then his marriage went tits up. And we never rehearsed again for about 12 years, wasn't it? Same old. We'd have an ever-changing lineup. I'd just show them songs inside the stage, and, you know, after sound check and that. Blagged it. Got away with it most of the time as well.
Yeah, well, if you kept that up for 12 years, you must have been doing something right.
We actually got better as well.
And I mean, that attitude seems to me similar to like a jazz band where you get a whole load of musicians coming together and they'll, you know, they know the chords and they'll improvise around it. Is it that sort of attitude?
Well, if I'm very sporadic on my songwriting. Sometimes I'll come up with a few within a few months. Other times, you know, one every few years. So, you know, we do a sound check and I'd show them a song and we'd play in the set that night, you know. If it didn't work, then man, we'd do it again the next time until it does work.
Yeah.
There have been a few gigs where I remember a few gigs we were in the pub playing. More often than not, we would everyone in the band would get a solo, me included, and some of them. So Ian would normally wander off into the crowd and interact with the crowd while we were soloing. I remember the guitarist was soloing and we were looking around saying, where's Ian? And he was, we looked back and I was still playing and I looked out the window and he was outside smoking a cigarette, watching the band while doing his solo. And you can catch you off guard sometimes.
That's fantastic, yeah. There's one bit of XTC's career that I haven't included that I know that you were around a little bit for, Ian, because you write about it in the book, which is that 1982 period where touring came to an end, Andy's mental health wasn't good. But by that point, they'd become, you know, there is a theory that they were on the cusp of super greatness, but certainly they were in terms of fame and popularity. But they were certainly, their trajectory was on the up. Does it... It must. It seems to me, you know, within the space of about 5 years, they'd achieved a tremendous amount, and yet they were the band that you would have remembered from The Affair only a few years before. What are your memories of 1982 and that sort of period?
The last song I saw XTC play live was in 1981 at Bath University.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was intending going to the Swindon gig on the 1982, you know, tour that ended up, you know, being cancelled after a few shows. But yeah, I just thought it was a real shame. You know, they worked really hard. They, you know, as you say, on the cusp of superstardom, I thought as well. And then for it all, the band didn't thought of this, but, you know, the way they've been going about it did with Andy not wanting to play live anymore. The first I knew about it is I bumped into Terry in the town centre. I thought you were supposed to be in America. And he told me about Andy's breakdown and everything. And, yeah, it's a shame, but it's good to see that they carried on for all them years and, you know, on a musical level, came out with even better stuff. You know? So there's your limits of what you can do with a four-piece band live compared to what you can do in a studio with pretty much unlimited tracks and, to some extent, unlimited time. You know, if you, and in the days when Virgin were still, you know, very supportive of them.
Lee, a question for you coming back to Ian's book, A Big Fish in a Small Puddle, which I think Amazon is the best or the most convenient place for you to sell it through, isn't it? Lee, given that you come from Swindon and this is an entirely Swindon story, or stories in the plural, how do you feel about a book that itemises all of this stuff that was going, I mean, underground is maybe not quite the right word, but it's not mainstream, it's not just generally known, but it really sort of captures a particular strand of life in a particular town that wouldn't normally get its focus on. Is it important for you that a book like this exists?
I think it's great. I mean, the mainstream tends to completely miss Swindon. So it's actually nice to see something, you know, stories that you know, you bore witness to. Yes, it's nice, and you know, you can read about places that you actually know, which is nice.
And people you know, of course. And for both of you, this could be a sort of rounding up story, but I'm just thinking about Swindon as a place, and it's something you've touched on already a little bit because of its importance in the early gigs that the punk bands were getting. But I've heard it said that Swindon is really like a northern English city that happens to be in the south or southwest. It's sort of slightly in its wrong places. It's got that sort of more of a working class history and so on about it. But it's interesting. I mean, it's interesting that you two are still in the area. All of XTC are still in the area. There was something about that town that seems to hold people. Despite it not being a sort of big tourist attraction, or you know, it's not pretty in a conventional way. Is there something about Swindon what is it about Swindon that has its hold on you?
There is definitely some sort of tractor beam that or some sort of surface tension or whatever that keeps everyone here.
Yeah,
you know, it is true. You know, you can take the boy out of Swindon, but you can't take Swindon out of the boy. I don't know. There's just something about the place. I don't know. What do you think it is?
People, I think. You know, so I've been doing this now for nearly 50 years, and I'd say 90% of Swindon has never heard of me.
Yeah.
But the 10% have, most of them become good friends. So that's a good enough. You know, I can wander in a pub and be anonymous if I want to. You know, but, you know, people in live music know who I am. I know who most of them are because they've been supporting mine and loads of other gigs, you know, most of their adult lives, if not all their lives. And yeah, it's just some very nice people, lots of characters, lots of great musicians. It seems to have been, when I was in my youth even, there was a retirement home in the Swindon area for, you know, 50s rock and rollers and things like that. So I played with some of them. Yeah, I couldn't put a finger on it, but I'd say it's more the people than the place.
Yeah. And it's not, I mean, you've obviously found enough places to play live, but I wouldn't have thought there's an excess of venues and so on, but maybe I'm wrong in that.
Not if you play original music. There's very few. And I refuse to playing a straight covers band, it doesn't appeal to me at all. Or as Lee said, you know, playing everything the same every night doesn't appeal to me. I have a bit of spark, I have a bit of lunacy about it. You know. Put a little smile on people's faces. You know. Play the songs that other people don't dare to. As Terry was a gig of ours not long after he came back to Swindon, and he said to me after the gig, "Wow," he said, "I've never seen anyone put a full-on Hawkwind number with all the spacey effects in the corner of a pub before."
And Swindon's also a great place to get to other places too.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good transport links.
Yeah. And that sense of it being by the, you know, right on the country, but also a town, you know, there's something to be said for that, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah. As Ian says, the best thing about Swindon is the people. I think the worst thing about Swindon is the people that run it. It's got a lot of characters in, a lot of nice places. It's, you know, it's the same as everywhere. There's good and bad. It's exactly the same as everywhere, really. What do you think about it? You've been here.
Well, I have been there because I guess it's why I'm asking the question, because it doesn't strike me as if you go in the old town, then I'm trying to be as polite as possible. If you, the old time has it, that sort of quality and character. You think, oh yeah, I can see why someone would be attracted to this. But then there's all the sort of modern development that seems quite soulless to me and not particularly attractive.
Yeah.
But
I've seen that everywhere.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, but some places have. It depends. I mean, there's the history. You know, some places were bombed more during the war and so on and so on, and the expansion of Swindon because of over the years because it expanded, and it seems to me it's like some towns are really immediate when you go to them, because they've got Roman history or whatever it might be. But Swindon isn't as obvious as that, I suppose.
No, obviously it has the big railway link here. Mm-hmm. I think it's that. I think that history, that side of the Swindon history, is slowly being eroded away. But yeah, it's the people more than anything that keeps me here. Obviously, I've got family, but I've got a lot of friends here, and that's kind of the main thing that keeps us in Swindon, yes, I guess.
Yeah. Great. Well, you are two of the good people from Swindon, and it's been lovely to talk to you both, and to be entertained by Ian's book and everything you've been doing. So thank you very much for chatting to us today, and hope the book does well. Encourage all listeners to go on Amazon. It's called A Big Fish in a Small Puddle, and it's subtitled The Ian Dosa Story. So thank you very much for that, both of you.
Thank you, Mark.
If you want to find it quickly on Amazon, you need to look for E Bird, BYRD, and the words Big Fish. Thank you for helping me, Bookmark, and thanks for having us. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. Yeah, good tip. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
What do you call that noise?
A big thank you to Ian Dosa and Lee Moulding for the conversation, and to Beth Link for her instrumental. Do get in touch with me if you would like to develop that piece of music further. And thank you once again, not only for listening, but also for supporting the podcast on Patreon. And you can join those people at patreon.com/Mark Fisher. Thanks in particular to the following knights in shining karma: Terry Arnott, Kevin Burt, Lorenzo Charchi, Cale Corbett, Liam Duggan, Jamie Dunn, Jeff Farris, Evan Fish, Leslie Gooch, Mike Grafe, Robert Graham, Camille Henry, Stephen Hope, Alan Hughes, Marek Krause, Jesper Cumberg, Robert Lawlor, Liz Lynch, Mary Meikle, Yusef Murrah, Amy Parkinson, Mark Reed, James Reimer, Michael Sutcliffe, Steve Swift, Mark Thomas, Nigel Waller, John Wedemeyer, and Martin Whitley. And that is the end of this episode. I'll see you back for episode 51. Bye.